Hello and welcome to episode 46 of A Little Bird Told Me. My co-host Philippa and I are two freelance writers on a frankly heroic mission. We're here to help you avoid the pitfalls that plague our profession and become the most wonderful wordsmith you can be. Freelancing is tough, and it can be a really lonely old world out there, so our hope is that this podcast will just be a little ray of sunshine in a world where you can find yourself working from bed, eating cornflakes from the packet for lunch, and not seeing another living person for years on the trot. To make sure you don't miss this little sunbeam of writerly wisdom, we've made it super easy to subscribe. You can tune into us via iTunes, RSS feed, Stitcher Smart Radio, or just on the Podomatic site itself. So no matter how you want to listen, do make sure you stop by our homepage. That's at alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com, and you'll find a whole range of links and resources on there to accompany all the episodes. There are blog posts, transcripts, videos, websites, all sorts. You'll also find links to both mine and Pip's social media profiles and websites, so you can come and have a chat with us. I'm Laurie Hartshorn.
And I am Philippa Willett. And today we're going to talk about a particularly tricky situation, and that is what to do if you get criticism or negative feedback from a client. First of all, you can feel reassured that it does happen to everybody at some point. You can be the best writer in the world, but if somebody doesn't like your style or approach, then it doesn't matter how good you are. You need to deal with their response. You can look at any successful writer, even someone like J.K. Rowling, Stephen King, who are incredibly successful and very highly thought of, and there will be people who hate what they do.
J.K. Rowling was turned down by about 5 publishing houses, I think, before she found a publisher.
And I bet they all regret it bitterly now.
I hope so.
Yes, indeed. So what we're going to look at is how to deal with it, both in terms of responding to the client, looking at the work you may have to do to fix it, but also looking at what to do if you find it really dents your professional confidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's a moment that every freelancer, or at least every decent freelancer, dreads in their career, hearing back from a client that they're not happy. And when you've put a lot of time and effort into a piece of work and you hand it over thinking not just that it's all A-OK, but that it's really good,
yeah,
it really can make your heart sink to your boots when you get it back and the client's not happy. Now, there are a couple of overarching reasons that the client might not be happy. It might be something inherent in the work itself, or it might be something about your working methods, the way that you interact with them, or, you know, the way that you do business. Either way, you need to listen to the person properly, let them know that you've listened to them, and decide what action to take from there. And we're going to look at a few ways to deal with trouble with feedback and criticism in just a moment.
The first thing to do in most circumstances, I would say, is to establish exactly what has gone wrong. If you get an email from a client who isn't happy with something you've submitted to them, you want to have your facts straight before you get into too much discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because one thing to remember is that the urge to defend yourself, it can be quite overwhelming sometimes, particularly, I think, if you're caught by surprise, say they phone you up, or if your client's not delivering the news to you in the most pleasant of ways, so if you're getting an ear bashing, basically. If you combine the two and say your client's phoned you up for an ear bashing, it can be tempting to kind of leap in and just refute everything that they're saying.
Definitely. So before you do that, before you dive in, if it's a phone call, you might want to say, let me look into this, I'll call you back in half an hour.
Yeah.
Or if it's an email, then you can just take the time you need. So you need to assess the situation as objectively as you can. So some things to look at are, did you misread the instructions or guidance? Did you get an email asking you to write an article about Google AdWords and you wrote it about Google AdSense, for instance? If you're honest, did you perhaps rush it? Did you perhaps not do your best? Were you late in delivering it? And did you proofread it properly? They're just some of the first things to check if you've been told that your work wasn't up to scratch, and the exact feedback from the client might well tell you directly what they think's wrong. If they say, I said AdWords, you've written about AdSense, then you know what's happened. Mm-hmm. But it's always worth double checking anyway, because they might think they said one thing, but if you've got an email trail, you can check.
Yeah.
Perhaps there was a communication failure and you both thought you were thinking about the same thing, but you actually had very different expectations because things weren't set out clearly. Don't head straight to assigning blame. There might not be any. And if there is, it might be yours, it might be theirs, or it might be somebody else's. But really, just try to establish what's going on. Now, myself, I tend to offer one revision within the fee I charge for my writing. So if anybody's not happy, I will rework it once. And in reality, this very rarely happens, which is reassuring in many ways. So in many cases, but it, you know, if I did get feedback with a problem, in most cases, I just rework it according to what the client specified and resubmit it. That's not a problem. But if you've got beyond that stage, if you've done a massive project and the client wants really significant reworking of it, then you do need to look at it more carefully. So what we're going to look at first is how to handle this if it actually was your fault. If you realise that you didn't double check your facts, or you know in your heart that you rushed a piece of work, or that you were a bit half-hearted about it, then it is down to you to fix your mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is quite often the case, and I'm kind of risking my reputation on that a little bit.
But if but this is what we're talking about. It does happen to everybody sometimes.
Well, it does, and I don't think it happens to me very often, and that's because I take care to make sure that it doesn't happen, and it's because I've been doing it for years, and obviously it happened more often when I was starting out.
Yeah, of course.
And if you... What I was sort of thinking is, if you think about it statistically, it's more likely to be your fault, I think, as the writer.
Yeah.
You're the one spending hours with your nose stuck in that piece of work, and there's just simply more time and scope for errors on your part than elsewhere, because the only way, really, that the client can be at fault is in the initial communication stages.
Yeah.
Or if they've simply... thought that there's an error and there isn't, which kind of at that point there's not really a problem, it's their issue.
Yeah. And if you want to be taken seriously as a freelancer, this does involve taking responsibility when you mess up. Trying to get out of mistakes, on the other hand, is a direct route to a bad reputation, frankly. So if you send off an article with a huge typo in the title or an unfinished sentence somewhere in the middle, suck it up and fix it. If it was your fault, you fix it.
Yeah, I mean, words are complicated things. You can get a bit word blind by the end of a giant piece of writing or proofreading.
Definitely.
It's just the way it is. Those are the kinds of mistakes I think that most freelancers would expect to find more frequently than others.
Yeah.
If you're a decent freelancer, then... you know, the whole thing shouldn't be a massive issue sort of frequently.
Yeah.
But everybody makes typos sometimes. Try not to, and everybody misses things when they're proofreading.
Yeah, I did a solo episode a while ago, which I'll link to in the show notes, about how to proofread your own work.
I liked that one.
Thank you. And the reason it has an episode of its own dedicated to it is because that's actually harder than it sounds.
It really is. It really, really is.
Yeah, because you read what you think you wrote, generally, rather than what you necessarily did write.
Yeah.
And so in that episode are some tips and tricks to help you see your own writing with fresh eyes. But proofreading is often where the problems arise if you make mistakes yourself, because you proofread it all but don't bother checking the title, for instance, or you proofread what you think you wrote, not what you did write.
Yeah, I have a client for whom I actually do proofread. It's an academic proofreading project.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of words. And I was chatting to the editor-in-chief at this client agency, and we were having a good chinwag, and he just said, I'm an editor, but I'm not a proofreader. And he said, because... I find the writing too interesting. He's like,
I'll read
it and I'll learn something from it. And I'll think, wow, that's really interesting, but I would have phrased that like this, and I would have done that. And I'll get to the end of it, and I'll realise that I've not proofread any of it. I've just read it.
I proofread a dissertation a few months ago that was so interesting that what I had to do was give in and just read it and then go back to proofread. Because I started proofreading it straight off, but I realised that was happening. It was really interesting.
It's a different kind of reading, isn't it?
Yeah, and so I went, okay, I'm just going to read this and then I'll know what I want to know, and then I could start again from the beginning. It's,
Yeah, I find the same problem, actually. I proofread and edit other people's fiction.
Oh, of course, you're bound to want to know what happens.
Yes! I'm reading on, I'm thinking, oh, but what happens to the Count? And what happens to the lady? And oh, my goodness, what's going to go on? And then I realise that actually I'm not checking the punctuation.
Like, yeah, it reminds me of someone I used to know who was reading Harry Potter to her son at bedtime.
Mm-hmm.
And by about halfway through the first book, she just had to read him a chapter and then go and read the rest of it herself. She couldn't wait for the next one.
I imagine I'd be the same if I had children. They'd be asleep and I'd be next to them going, Yeah, I mean, going back to, like, the idea of making mistakes in work, because, you know, regular listeners will know that we do go off on tangents occasionally.
And that's not even including the ones I cut out in the edit, which are epic.
People would pay to hear them. They're
just
really
for the record, however far we are into the podcast now, we have been Laurie and I have been talking for an hour and 35 minutes, just so you know how long we take recording these things.
How dedicated we are. Indeed. So I had I'd hired somebody a while back, because as regular listeners will know, I do hire quite a number of freelancers. I'd hired somebody to do some proofreading for me. And when I opened the document that this person had completed for me, there was a huge formatting error right smack bang in the middle of the title on the first page.
Oops.
Yeah, and it really worried me, because I needed this document proofread properly.
Of course.
As you do, if you need something proofread, you need it to be word perfect.
Yeah.
And that's why I'd got somebody else to proofread it for me. You know, as we said earlier, proofreading your own work is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
Now, because I'm a freelancer as well as a client, I know it sounds kind of arrogant, but I was able to take a step back, as we've sort of mentioned earlier, just as I would do if somebody came to me and said there was a mistake.
Yeah, you don't want to go in shouting.
No, of course not. And I went through the rest of the document, which was marked up, so it was easy to see what that person had done.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really thoroughly proofread. Like, I could see that they'd taken on board the guidelines, and there were a lot of guidelines in place.
Yeah.
Like, there was a whole style guide to be adhering to.
Yeah.
So the rest of it was really, really well proofread, but they'd just missed the first page, which just had the title on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got back to them, and I asked if there was any reason that they'd formatted the title in that way. You know, sort of, I didn't want to patronise, but I did want to give them the benefit of the doubt, and just said, like, I've noticed the formatting on the title. It's all in caps lock. Is there any particular reason that that has happened? And they got straight back to me, and they were honest, and they said that somehow they'd just completely missed the first page. And I think they handled it really well.
Yeah.
They sent me a short, to-the-point email that basically explained what had happened, apologised, and said, I'll make sure it won't happen again.
Yeah.
So while it wasn't ideal that it happened in the first place, we're human, and it was basically just the perfect way to deal with it from my point of view.
Definitely. You must never fall into the trap of thinking that if you admit you made a mistake, then you'll look bad. Because you won't save face, you'll just dig yourself deeper and deeper into a hole. If Laurie's freelancer there had got back to her and said, oh, it didn't look like that on my computer and it looked fine, and, you know, Laurie would have immediately lost respect for them, I would imagine, and not hired them again. Whereas instead, getting back to you and saying, I'm so sorry, I don't know how I missed it, genuinely sorry, it won't happen again, then you both leave the encounter feeling okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've hired that person again. It's not a problem. You know, everybody makes mistakes. I make mistakes. That person made a mistake.
Yeah.
They handled it in the right way. The document was otherwise well done. So I'm happy to go with that person again.
Yeah.
Because I trust that person will take on board the feedback, as they said they would.
And if they were quick to acknowledge their mistake and apologise, then that suggests they would be open to the feedback as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, I do hire other freelancers on a really, really regular basis. And some of them are pretty new to writing and they need a bit of TLC before they're really up to speed. So, again, I don't mean to sound patronising, but I've got to know the warning signs in terms of how people respond to feedback.
Yes, how kind of receptive they are, I guess.
Yeah, as to how hopeful it's going to be that I'm going to have a long-term working relationship with them.
Mm.
Now, I do see people who will go out of their way, and I'm talking like a 10-mile detour, to not apologise for making mistakes.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's a me thing. I'm saying a lot because I feel really judgmental, because, of course, as we say, everybody makes mistakes, but I don't know if it's a me thing or if it's something that most people, most clients would feel, but I really, really don't appreciate it when somebody seems to be giving me reasons for the mistake, but deliberately stopping short of apologising for it. It's almost like they're trying to excuse it, but not take responsibility for it. And in my opinion, that is just wrong.
Yeah. I had a situation a few months ago where a client asked for a series of blog posts, and it was a communication error where basically one of their blog post titles that they suggested was confused and conflated two different topics,
right,
as if it was just one. Now, they didn't spot that when they sent it me, and I didn't spot it when I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I obviously just took in one half of the title and wrote that blog post. And it turned out that they intended the other half of the title to be written. So they should have double-checked it, but I should have double-checked it as well.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I sent them this blog post and they said thanks, but actually I'd have preferred that other one. Yeah. And we quickly realised what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got back to them and said, I'm really sorry, I should have spotted that. I don't know how I haven't. I'll do the other one for you this afternoon.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, similarly, you know, it's not your fault. We should have double checked as well. If you could get it to us now, that would be great. And that was it. That was resolved. Yeah. I still work with them every week.
Yeah. And that lost.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the kind of thing that had I gone, no, you wrote it wrong, you know, had I become defensive and obstructive, then the relationship would have broken down, I think. Whereas it's actually a very valuable one to me.
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember that making a mistake doesn't make you a bad person or a bad freelancer or a bad writer. You know, we make mistakes, me included. And if you make one on a piece of work for somebody else, there's no two ways about it. You are inconveniencing that person.
Yeah.
Now, they might notice it, at which point they'll know that they've been inconvenienced, or they might not notice it. And you can get people into some real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you don't fact check in like a press release.
Yeah.
You can start straying into the realms of libel. You know, if you're not careful with your writing, you can make claims that aren't true. You can attribute quotes to people who didn't make them.
Yes.
You know, if you're not careful, some of your mistakes can have serious consequences for your clients.
Mm.
So if you do make a mistake in work that's going external, make no mistake in the fact that it is a problem. It is your fault, and it's up to you to apologise if you've left a mistake in a piece of work and you've handed it over. And I think most clients will feel much, much better towards you for apologising. You know.
Yes, I agree.
I do.
This applies in real life as well. Even if you think about it beyond work, if you're in a pub and you spill your drink on someone, you apologise because it's the right thing to do. If it's the grown-up thing to take responsibility when you mess up.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that in every aspect of my life, not just work.
No, I definitely do. You know, you can't expect a client to be happy about a mistake.
No.
So, of course, you might get I really wish that hadn't happened from them. And they might be a bit frosty towards you, but I don't think, as Pip pointed out, I don't think that it would be anything compared to what you'd get if you just denied that the mistake was your fault. I certainly know that I would treat people a lot better if they own their mistakes.
Yeah, yeah.
So one point I do want to make is if you have to admit your mistake to somebody, be clear, be concise, be apologetic, but don't be ridiculous. So if you have to apologise to somebody, or if you find yourself apologising to somebody, remember that it's not about you. It's about the inconvenience that you caused them. It's about their needs and the trouble that they've been put to. So they don't need your life story. They don't need to hear how your husband's got stomach flu and your cat got stuck up a tree and you just couldn't concentrate and, you know, your favourite soap star died. And that's the kind of stuff you tell your mates over a cup of coffee at the end of that day.
Yeah.
That's what you unwind with. That's your story over a glass of wine. What your client needs to know is that you made a mistake, that it matters to you that you handed in something with a mistake in it,
yeah,
and that you'll make every effort to prevent it happening again in future. That's all they need to know from you.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want a continued relationship, if you want to be respected in your business, that's how you have to handle it.
I was going to say, you know, there are things like, say, if you've had like a death in the family.
Yes.
Or, you know, something really, really serious has gone, or you've been ill, or you've had a migraine. You can say, I'm so sorry, I've been ill.
Yeah.
I understand it doesn't make blah, blah, blah. And carry on from there. I'm so sorry, we're having a few family issues at the moment. I really should have checked better. You can allude to something, but don't go into all the details because they don't need to know.
Yes, I have a regular client that I submit blog posts to, and one week it was the day I was writing their second blog post and I had a massive broadband outage. And then through the day it was coming on and off and on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did early on was email them the piece of work that was already complete.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm having broadband problems, so I wanted to send you the one that's ready now in case I can't get it to you later. I'll do my best to get the second one to you later, but if I don't, this is my situation. Yeah. I didn't go, so I rang my ISP and then it went off again and then it looked like it was fixed. And, oh my God. You know, I just said, this is the situation. I'm very sorry that it may disrupt. As it was fine. I was able to submit the second piece of work the same day. Yeah. But it seemed the responsible thing to do was explain that this may become a problem, but also he didn't want to know the ins and outs. He needed to know that I was having broadband problems. That was it.
Yeah. And I think you make an interesting point there about sending over a piece of work that was done and then hanging fire on the other one. Because what you could have done, I'm not sure about what the blog post was about, but what you could have done is do a flaky piece of work, skimp on the research because you had no internet access, and then send it over. And sometimes you do have to make a judgment call in terms of handing things in late. Say if you have a similar situation. I kind of think it is mostly better to, as you did, let the client know that you're having those issues, but also not hand in something substandard to try and get away. Do you understand what I mean? To try and stop yourself being late, handing something substandard.
Yeah, definitely. Now, what we've been talking about there is how to handle things if you make a mistake. But sometimes it may be that you get criticism from a client that you fundamentally disagree with. And this is where it gets a lot more tricky.
And this is the bit I like, because it's like, right, enough of us being rotten. Let's talk about how awful clients can be. And they can. They can be awful, awful people.
And the vast majority of the time, we are right.
Yes. Vast majority. Always. Almost.
So if you've agreed in advance to a certain number of revisions, like we mentioned earlier, then you are most likely contractually obliged to carry them out. And even if the legality of that isn't clear, you've made an agreement, and it's nearly always good practice to stick to this, almost always, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, I think with a lot of writing agreements, and I've certainly had this situation in my own life, not with me as the freelancer, but with me as the client, I don't think many people will chase you, even if you are contractually bound. If you're talking like a few hundred pounds here or there, it's not worth somebody's money to chase you for something.
Mm-hmm.
But, as Pip says, if you've got an agreement in place with somebody, you should think extremely hard before you start breaking that contract. Yeah. Because, yeah, I can't see anybody's reputation recovering, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Even, you know, neither of us are lawyers and neither of us know for sure, you know, how binding these things are. But even just on an ethical basis and thinking of your reputation, you know, if that client says to someone else she promised a revision and she refused to do it, that sounds awful. It sounds like you don't fulfill what you agree to do.
No, absolutely. And it's not good, you know, and it's one more reason, really, all of that. It's a reason to spend a good few hours preparing a template writing agreement that you can send to your clients when you agree a new project. If you get to know your writing agreement and what it binds you to as much as you can, we're not saying become a lawyer, it will pay dividends in the future. And if you've got an awkward client who finds a loophole in that agreement that, say, allows them to request like 15, 20 unlimited revisions for free, you really will be sorry that you didn't spend more time on it, because projects can be huge and one round of revisions.
Yeah.
That can be editing another book.
That's it.
If, writing if, another report.
Yeah. If you're talking about a blog post, it's going to take you a couple of hours. If you're talking about a 32-page website, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, and if you've made like a tone mistake or a branding mistake or a style mistake, that's not going to be easily undone.
Now, we have talked a few times in the podcast before about having to write things that a client firmly wants but that you think is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from those previous discussions, it's safe to say that we would both recommend making suggestions to your client and discussing it with them if you think that's appropriate. So perhaps saying, I see where you're coming from. My advice would actually be to do it this way instead.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, if they're paying you, you probably have to do what they want you to do.
Yeah, I mean, I have one particular client who likes me to be grammatically incorrect about certain things because they prefer the way it looks with the apostrophes.
Yeah.
And it really kills me every single time. They just don't like apostrophe S's on the end of words that finish with an S.
Yeah, that's it. And it's that kind of thing. Yeah, we might cringe, but often you just have to do what they want you to do.
Yeah.
One difficult exception to this that you'd probably have to decide on a case-by-case basis, but that we'll touch on today, is work that would be going out under your own name.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing work that's going out under a client's name and you're embarrassed about the apostrophe situation, it's under their name at the end of the day.
Yeah.
If a client or editor wants you to make changes that you feel very strongly against or that you know are unwise and it will be under your authorship, then you may well want to fight it a bit harder to make it right.
Yeah, I mean, I've had similar situations with my literary editing stuff.
Yeah.
I've had clients who simply will not let me edit their baby. you know, they hire an editor, and it tends to be, I'm going to make a generalization, it tends to be indie authors.
Yeah.
I find, because there's still that tussle in the independent publishing sector as to, do you get beta readers, do you get a professional proofreader, editor, what do you do? And then if you go back to someone and say, well, this doesn't make sense and that doesn't work and that's not a sentence and this is grammatically incorrect and that doesn't read very well.
Yeah.
Because, of course, a lot of fiction is very, very subjective.
Yeah.
A lot of the time the client can turn around and say, well, I don't agree. I wrote it that way. It's artistic. It's this, it's that.
Yeah, I think I don't do literary editing like Laurie does, but I do proofreading, which can involve fiction work. But I think more of the case with editing, I do get the impression that some fiction writers send things to the editor but want it mainly to be an ego-stroking exercise.
I knew what you were going to say.
Yeah, rather than a genuine skilled look at this from an objective point of view.
You have to want to know what's wrong with your book if you send it to an editor.
Yes, and a lot of people, because they've put so much work into it,
yeah,
they kind of expect to get it back with it's perfect.
Oh, it's marvellous. That was so moving.
There are no changes I can make because it's perfect. And when they don't get that, it can be hard to take. And I, you know, I do understand that. But if you're going to send it to an editor, then that's the right thing to do. First of all, you absolutely should. But you also have to expect them to do their job.
Yeah, and I think if you're a writer, if you're an author, you have to make sure that you know that you understand your building materials. And what I mean by that is that you understand grammar and punctuation and narrative theory.
Structure.
Structure, formatting.
Yeah.
All the things that help you build up a novel or a book. Because then when your editor comes back to you and says, look, there's a problem with the structure, there's a problem with the punctuation, there's a problem with your narrative voice,
yeah,
this doesn't make sense, your point of view doesn't make sense here, you don't have an omniscient narrator, what's going on here? You understand what you're being told and you're in a position to debate it.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't understand what you're being told, I know we're going a little bit off topic, but if you don't understand what an editor's telling you and you're arguing with them anyway, you're wasting your money.
Yeah.
Because you paid for that person to edit your work.
And you're wasting their expertise.
Yeah, you really are. You're wasting the whole situation, really.
No, the reason I don't do literary editing is because I don't have that basis in fiction writing that I would need. And Laurie does have that. And so if I had a query about something that was related to that, I would ask Laurie and I would, you know, respect her opinion because I know that she's far more expert than I am on narrative structures, on, you know, all those facets of fiction writing that I don't have the expertise in. Similarly, you know, we have different expertises and that's handy because we do check things out with each other a lot.
Yeah, like tech writing, for example.
That's it. That's what I do. That's, you know, I know how to do that. And if you're asking for somebody's help with something, and that includes getting an editor in, then it's pointless from a financial point of view on your part. It's pointless because you're not going to improve your writing if you don't listen to what they say. But also, people like Laurie are very skilled, and it's wasting their skills as well.
Yeah, and I think sort of going back to what we were saying about what to do if you think that the client is wrong.
Mm.
If I edit somebody's book, a lot of, and again, it tends to be an indie author thing, a lot of people will try and pay you less with the promise that your name will go in the book.
And if your name's going on the book as the editor, you don't want Amazon reviews to say horrible editing just because the client didn't implement anything you recommended.
Exactly, exactly. I've had it before, and I've had to say to somebody, well, I would say it anyway, but I don't want you to pay me less. If you're happy for me to be named as the editor, if I'm happy with the book as it, you know, as it sort of finishes, I'll put that in my portfolio. Thanks very much. You know, because with a lot of my clients, I sign non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, same, yeah. The vast majority of what I do, I think, is ghostwriting, really.
Yeah, no, vast majority here as well. And that's fine. I'm not in it for the glory. But yeah, no, if literary editing is quite hard to get into.
Mm.
So it is good to be able to say, I edited this book, and I edited that book, and I translated this book, and I edited that book, and I was involved in the publishing of this book. But if something is just terrible because the client has been so stubborn and really prevented me from doing my job, then I will have to say to that client, and I've done it before, I'm sorry, I think we've come to the end of this project. I've edited the book through. I've done the revisions that you requested because I too offer one round of revisions within reason, depending on the length of the manuscript.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be possible for me to put my name to this.
Yeah, similarly, I write various opinion pieces for various places. And opinion pieces, I guess it's quite similar to fiction in that it's very much you know. Yeah.
Extremely subjective, and you're putting a lot more of yourself out there, I think.
Definitely. And so if I sent something to a website editor and they edited it in a way that changed my not changed my opinion, that misrepresented my opinion, I would feel very wary of that going up under my name.
Of course.
Whereas if I wrote a blog post for a client about a tech topic under their name and they wanted something I didn't recommend, that would be for them to worry about, not me.
Yeah, you'd shake your head, but get on with it.
Yeah. Alternatively, if it's going up on The Guardian under Philippa Willits, then I want it to be what Philippa Willits thinks, really. And that there's no easy answer that we can give you for this is how you deal with that situation. But a massive part of it is communication.
Yes.
And good communication, not just replying and going, no!
Is that something you've tried personally?
Well, it can be an initial reaction. You know, if you get an email back that says something awful, your first thought can just be, oh my God.
No, I've had those clients saying, what about this?
Yeah.
And I've almost managed to fit my whole fist in my mouth at the
exactly.
time.
And
the screen.
So get beyond that before you even reply.
Yeah.
And make sure you have a reasonable response. Don't be insulting. Don't even, you can express anger, but in an appropriate way.
Yeah.
Don't just send a rant.
When do you think that you would express anger?
I think if, I know of some writers who write an opinion piece and then it goes up on a prominent website and the sub-editor has put a title on that, that does not reflect the opinion being expressed. And it misrepresents it, really.
Yeah.
And then because...
It's like link baiting, isn't it, often?
Yeah.
To get people to click by being deliberately controversial.
Exactly. And because of the nature of the internet, people will see the title and immediately attack the writer.
Yeah.
By saying, I can't believe you said that. And I've known writers in that case have to contact the editor really quite firmly and express anger and say, I'm really not happy that this has gone up under that title. It misrepresents what I've said. It makes me look judgmental or offensive or whatever it is. And I'm not happy. And I think in that kind of circumstance where something is going wrong in the now, that may be a time to express appropriate anger.
I can't think of many examples of times in my sectors, at least, that I would have to be, that I would have to express anger. I think opinion piece writing is probably quite unique in that.
Yeah.
And media writing as well, because obviously it's on far more of a public platform and you've got much more of an open channel between your reader and the writer and the publication.
Yeah.
I think one occasion that I did have to express anger, and it was really more at the way I was being treated. I'd made amends. It was when I was working in-house for somebody actually on a project.
Yeah.
And I'd made amends to something as requested by somebody high up on the board. They got no knowledge of writing, and the amends were arbitrary. It almost seemed like a domination exercise on their part. Like they wanted to say that something was wrong with the piece, so here it was. It was like swap the order of these bullet points or something. So I did it, and then they got back and said, can you swap them again? I don't like it. So I did it again, because as I say, I was in-house, so I was working on that kind of pay at the time. And then they got back to me, and they'd proofread the whole thing. Well, they'd read it through anyway. And then they decided there were more mistakes and more mistakes. And I kid you not, we got to round 17 of amends by email. And this person then went and sent me a link to something they clearly just Google searched for, which is a guide to technical copywriting. They just sent me the URL.
Oh, dear.
And at that point, I think it's fair to say I expressed a certain level of anger.
I think that sounds entirely reasonable by that.
Knowing me, I imagine that you can picture the scene.
I can imagine the exact words, to be honest, yeah.
Yes. and I didn't get an apology from that person, but that person certainly did get a telling off from higher up.
Yeah.
But I wasn't rude. I was extremely firm.
Yeah, you lose the moral high ground if you're rude. You then are yourself in the situation that possibly merits criticism. And that's the last thing you want. You want to come out of the discussion absolutely flawless, really.
Sparkling clean. I mean, it's like I mentioned, I did a solo episode recently on professional courtesy. And we were both talking recently, weren't we, about clients who had been unreasonable with us and rude to us.
Yeah.
And how we dealt with that. And as I said in that episode, if you get into a flame war with a client or you are rude to them, you lose pretty much all right to complain.
Yes, you do.
And it certainly doesn't help anything. It ends up, you can end up reproaching yourself more than anything, because having a to-do with a client can be extremely stressful. Even having something that's not quite an argument with a client, just having a backwards and forwards discussion. I'm thinking again of fiction writing and fiction editing. Even having that backwards and forwards about, but it doesn't make sense, but I like it, but it doesn't make sense, but I like it.
Yeah.
But it's not something you would write in a book. It doesn't make sense to your reader. Yes, but I want it in there.
Yeah.
Even that can be extremely stressful.
Yeah.
And if you look back on something like that or worse, and you realise that you've worsened the situation by being rude, you're not going to get any sleep at all.
Yeah. If in doubt, write the email and save it as a draft.
Yes.
And then come back to it the next day and read it and see whether you come across as firm but reasonable, or whether you come across as a bit rude and arrogant and all those things you don't want to be.
Yeah.
Or send it to a friend who's in a similar job.
Yeah.
The number of times Laurie and I check, you know, am I being reasonable here with each other? And it helps a lot because also we're very honest with each other.
Yeah.
You know, I might say, I think that sentence is a bit questionable, or Laurie might say, I'd add this, or, you know, it's, you have to be honest with yourself.
Yeah. And it can be helpful, can't it? It can be helpful because, as well as the freelancer, I think when you're starting out, and I suppose it's a bit more on topic now, when you're starting out, it can be easy to take mistakes on yourself. Because some clients will say, that's a mistake, this is a mistake, that's wrong, this is wrong.
Especially, actually, if they think you're new.
Yes. If they think you're new to it, it can just be people drawing the lines, because getting a copywriter in, you have to let go of some of that control.
Yeah.
Your client has had to loosen the reins a little bit and give them to you, and it can be a real sticking point.
Some can't handle it.
No, they really can't. So don't take a default position of, I'm always wrong.
Or, I clearly don't know what I'm doing because I've only been doing this for 3 months. You might actually be right. Check. Well, don't assume you're right. Check.
If you've been in a way that leaves room for the possibility that you're right. Don't think, gosh, I must be wrong. Actually, take it from as neutral a position as you can.
If you've been challenged on a semicolon, read about semicolons. Make sure your understanding of them is exactly right. You might think you know, but you don't. Alternatively, if what you read shows that you're right, you've then got evidence that you can get back to the client with. I can't think of a single situation where researching and reading wouldn't help.
Yeah, it's only because it'll give you a bit of distance as well from the situation. It makes it all a bit more theoretical and a bit less emotional.
Yes, this isn't about me. This is about somebody's misunderstanding of whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. I think one good point to make is if it turns out that you are right and the client is wrong, just as you shouldn't be rude to a client, you should try not to be smug.
Oh, there is nothing worse than somebody being smug.
Yeah. Although you want to protect your reputation and you want to make it clear that actually this isn't a mistake on your part, don't pursue that point like a dog with a bone.
The words told you so should never be uttered.
No, it's not attractive. And likewise, if the client says, okay, you know, I'm not sure who's right, who's wrong, let's just drop it and move on, it's not good to say, yes, but I was wrong, but I was,
I know I was,
because look at these 7 links that I have for you. You can kind of just reassure the client that, you know, you do your research, you've done your training, you are good at what you do, and you'll continue to try and do the best job for them.
And sometimes if they're a person that can't admit they're wrong, then saying, let's just drop it and move on, might be the best they can do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that's right, but some people really can't admit they're wrong. And so by saying that, they may well be accepting that you're right, but they just can't bear to say it.
Yeah, you're right there. You know, don't expect a cookie for being right. We'd all like one.
But we're supposed to be right.
Well, yes, but I mean, it's very frustrating if you spent sort of 40 minutes out of your day emailing backwards and forwards with a client who's convinced that this apostrophe that you've put in is totally wrong and, oh dear, this really shouldn't have happened, should it? And if they turn out to be wrong, it can be really frustrating and you can want a cookie. You can want them to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, and they won't.
Yeah.
They most probably won't.
Yeah.
Or you'll get a half-hearted apology, or as Pip says, yeah, all right, let's just move on.
Yeah.
So don't be in it for the glory or the cookies, because you'll get neither.
So true.
Now, going back to the point that we made earlier about not assuming that you're wrong, I think it's also important to acknowledge that you shouldn't have to be treated like a badly behaved dog by your client.
Under any circumstances.
No, I think it actually, although it can be counterintuitive to stick up for yourself if a client's being belligerent, it can be quite tempting to just go, okay, or just leave it.
Mm.
I think it's actually counterproductive in the long term. And I think I speak for myself and Pip when I say that when we've put our foot down, albeit in a very respectful way, it's gone in our favour in the long term.
Yes, I agree. I got much better terms from one client after being very, very firm with them.
Mm-hmm.
And what Laurie was saying about belligerence, there are bullies in every aspect of life. And unfortunately, sometimes if you're unlucky, you will have a client who turns out to be a bully. And that is not something that anyone should have to put up with.
No.
Freelancer, employee, human being. It's not acceptable. And just because somebody's a client or just because they pay well doesn't ever mean you should put up with bad behaviour, even if you do make a mistake. If somebody is aggressive or abusive, then this is not something to lie back and take. It's something to either step away from the entire relationship or challenge, and we're not saying that's easy, that's very hard.
Yeah, no, it can be very, very difficult. I think we've discussed it before. I had a client that was extremely offensive to me.
Mm.
When I challenged the fact that they were paying me late repeatedly.
Yeah.
Now, I suggested payment terms that might be, it was nothing offensive. I suggested that they pay me either 50% or 100% in advance,
mm-hmm.
or that we could work on a retainer basis.
Yeah.
And the client sent me an extremely offensive email, which I chose to ignore.
Yeah.
I ignored it and I stepped away because I did not need to deal with people like that.
No.
No. If I'd have wanted to carry on, if that had been a more regular client or a client that I'd had a long-term relationship with, I might well have wanted to phone them up and say, just wanted to have a chat about the email that you sent me. I'm not happy with it because A, B, C, D, and E, and I wanted to know how we can move on from that in future.
Yeah. One other possible course of action, if you're dealing with, say, somebody in the marketing department and mm-hmm. they turn out to be very difficult to work with,
mm-hmm.
you could contact the marketing manager and ask to be assigned somebody else.
Yeah.
Now, that is difficult and that could break the relationship down.
Yeah.
But if you're in a situation where you feel you're being bullied or where you feel you're being treated badly, but it's a company that you'd like to continue working for, it is one way forward. That's best if often when you start dealing with a company, you will first talk to somebody quite high up
mm-hmm.
before you're allocated somebody else to manage you.
Yeah.
And so if you already have even a slight relationship with somebody higher up,
mm-hmm.
that can be an opportunity to say, I'm really upset by the way Steve is dealing with me. Mm-hmm. I would like to continue working with you because I really enjoy the work,
mm-hmm.
but I don't want to deal with him anymore. Then that manager may speak to Steve, who is, needless to say, made up, or allocate you somebody else.
I thought you meant made up, as in really pleased.
He's dead happy.
Super happy. For American listeners, made up can be a slang term in England for really, really happy.
Yes, but of course I meant imaginary.
I've had, off the top of my head, I've had two situations in which I've actually had to do what you have just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I had one client, it's a very, very large client company. I say very large. It's sort of, we're talking like 600-700 people in the company,
mm-hmm.
and me dealing with a large number of them because the departments vary.
Yeah.
And there's a manager in one department who was extremely rude about both me and my work.
Mm.
And he pointed out things that he wasn't happy with. And they weren't mistakes on my part. They were failures entirely on his part. And yeah. I had evidence of that in the mail trail. So I phoned that person up and basically told them what I thought. I told them I was disappointed because we'd previously had a very good working relationship.
Mm.
I was disappointed because that person is capable of communicating respectfully. And I was disappointed that person hadn't chosen to raise their concerns with me before popping it in the mail trail with lots and lots of people CC'd in.
Right.
And I got an apology over the phone, but I've never dealt with that person again.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of been mutually agreed.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot of witnesses to it. And I think those who read back through the mail trail realised that I was in the right and that
sure.
it was very unreasonable.
Yeah.
And I dare say a few of them had not bothered reading back through it and thought, ooh, what a bossy,
yeah.
you know, how stroppy she is.
Mm.
But I do know the department, and I know that I've been given other people in that department to deal with.
Yeah.
After that.
Of course, of course. And it sounds like you got some really good resolutions there of situations.
Certainly.
Yeah, where you wanted to maintain the relationship with the company and you yeah. wanted to continue the work,
mm-hmm.
but there was an individual in there who was obstructive or abusive yeah. or difficult to work with or unreasonable.
Yeah.
And you came to a way forward. Because I think if you have a one-off client who is very rude,
mm-hmm.
then that's kind of quite easy.
Yeah.
You just deal with it, do the work, and never agree to work with them again.
Yeah, and we've all had that, haven't we?
Yeah, whereas if it's a longer-term client or a repeat client, you do have more invested in making it work as a whole. And so you might, even away from, you know, if we take out of this scenario people who are unreasonable, there, if difficulties arise with criticism about work with a long-term client, you do have more invested in trying to fix it.
Absolutely. And I think it, kind of one final point on this, is I think it goes to show how important it is to keep your professional courtesy standards very high over the entire duration of your relationship with the client.
Yeah.
This is why professionalism is so, so important, because you know, with my other client company, the first example that I was talking about, that client is a huge part of my working week. That's a major client that I've got, and
yeah.
I've had them for a long time. And if they didn't know me to be a polite, friendly, reasonable person, they could have said, well, hang on a minute, you know, Bob or whoever it was, obviously Bob's made up as well and not happy, imaginary. Bob's nice, we like Bob, Bob's our colleague, and you're just a freelancer, get lost. So the fact that I was consistently polite and I've got that professional reputation with them, and the fact also, this is my second point, that the mail trail was there,
yeah.
and that I communicated very, very clearly in this mail trail,
yeah.
and kept records of everything, both of those things went in my favour, in both of the cases, actually.
And the other way round it works as well. If a client hires you for a one-off project and you send it with a mistake,
mm-hmm.
they won't hire you again.
No.
Whereas if you send a piece of work with a mistake to someone you've been working with for 18 months,
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't be happy.
No.
I'm not saying that's okay, and I'm certainly not saying you can get complacent with your long-term customers. That's the worst thing to do. But you're more likely, like Laurie said in her scenarios, you're more likely to be given the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it does work both ways. With you'll be more flexible with longer term clients, mm-hmm. and they'll be more flexible with you. If you've got somebody new and you mess up, you've probably lost that relationship.
Yeah.
And they will think, well, if they can't even make the effort for the first piece of work, I'm certainly not hiring them to do this regularly.
Absolutely.
And that's an understandable response.
Yeah, as a client, I hired somebody recently. They absolutely mucked everything up for the first week.
Yeah.
From the way they dealt with me to the customer service to the work itself.
Yeah.
There's no chance I would hire that person again.
Whereas if you've been working with that person for 6 months mm-hmm. and they'd been brilliant up to then,
yeah.
you might have said, okay, you had a really rough week. Can we sort it for this week?
Yeah. Absolutely. I don't have a zero tolerance policy to people because I understand, especially as a freelancer, as we've said, you know, we've come sort of full circle. I understand that people make mistakes.
One thing I hear a lot from clients is that they'll hire a writer who's great and then over time they get less and less good.
Mm.
And that's because they are getting complacent.
That's a shame.
And they put less, they think, oh, I've got this deal now, and spend less time. Now, I think most freelancers would probably admit to quadruple checking a piece of work for a new client.
Yes.
Where they might triple check it for a regular one.
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think most people would do that.
And I think that's fine because yes. when you're a client, you're dealing with a new style, a new sector.
Exactly. But anything more complacent than that and you're on dangerous ground.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in a situation where a client insists you're wrong, if they don't care that you're right and they're wrong, and just want you to be wrong anyway, or if you did genuinely make a mistake, that can have an impact on you. It can dent your confidence, really. To if you're, you know, if you take pride in your work and you realise that you did send something off with a big mistake in the middle of it, or if somebody's treating you as if you're useless, then it can have an effect on your self-confidence and your professional confidence. So in that case, the first thing to do is evaluate it honestly. It might be that, yeah, you did a bad piece of work, but that doesn't make you a bad writer. If you do lots and lots and lots of bad pieces of work, however, you may have to genuinely reassess your priorities and your skills.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I do feel like I'm always being the bad cop on this podcast, but there are a lot of writers out there, in my opinion, who should not be, and indeed are not, writers.
Yeah, my recommendation, which will come up shortly, is related to that very issue.
Well, I shall look forward to hearing it because this is my pet peeve at the moment. Saying you are a writer does not make you a writer.
Yeah.
I also don't believe something that's trotted out quite frequently in fiction circles, which is that everybody's a writer.
Everyone's got a novel inside them.
Yes.
I'm a professional writer and I don't have a novel inside me.
Are you sure?
Positive.
Have you checked?
I have.
Have you looked in your socks?
Yeah, no novel.
Still no novel. No, I completely disagree. Not everybody is a writer in the same way that not everyone is an astrophysicist.
Yeah, I'm not one of those either.
Are you sure?
Positive.
But I think if you are a writer, as in if writing is your job,
mm-hmm.
and you have been getting some negative feedback, or even if you haven't, it's very important to make sure that the things surrounding your writing work, and I'll explain that in a minute, the things surrounding your writing work are sorted out and working for you. Now, it might be that you aren't planning your time well enough and that you're rushing your work. It might be that your office is an absolute wreck and that you've got papers everywhere and you can't find anything, and the books that you use for your research are old and messy and have coffee cups sitting on top, in which case you probably need to clear your office out. It might be that you are an excellent writer and a really bad proofreader.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all sorts of things that you need to take into account. And the biggest one that I find, which kind of taps into what Pip was saying earlier, is the issue of training. Now, some writers think that because they can put pen to paper or fingers to a keyboard, they are a writer. But the number of writers I've spoken to over email and said, right, do you know how to write a press release? And they said, no.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no. And they can be quite polite about it, and quite eloquent about it, and say, no, I'm afraid I don't have any experience of that. Press releases are a basic. They're a basic writing skill.
They're bread and butter, aren't they?
They are. And as Pip and I have said and said and said, and will continue to say and say and say, training is super important, and it is your responsibility.
Yeah.
And it is vital to the success of your freelance career.
And anyone with internet access has no excuse, really.
No excuse. If you've got access to the... If you don't have internet access, stop it. What are you doing?
How are you listening to this for a start?
Yes. And if you don't have internet access, don't pull any excuses. If you don't know how to do the basic writing tasks, like writing a press release, understanding which bits of text you should link and which bits you shouldn't, and why hyperlinking click here isn't a good idea, then you should know those things. And if you don't know them, you should get some training done immediately, because sooner or later somebody will find you out for being a fraud, and that's what you're being. If you're saying you're a good writer and you're an up-to-date writer, but you don't know the basics, you're basically being cheeky with your clients, I think.
Mm.
Like at the moment, I'm taking an Open University course on fiction. How to write fiction, how to edit fiction, how to proofread fiction, all things around fiction,
mm-hmm.
so that I can understand where my fiction clients are coming from. I can improve my own writing. I can improve my editing. Philippa, at the moment, I mean, the last I heard from you, Pip, you were doing ethical journalism training.
That's the one from UCLA online.
And this isn't something that is going to directly benefit your clients.
No, it will make me a better writer in a wider sense, and it will improve my knowledge and my training.
Yeah.
But it's not a direct, like yours isn't. It's not like this is a course that leads to a job.
Yeah. It's something that, in fact, both of these courses are things that Pip and I have chosen to take on because we understand that the standard of work we deliver to clients needs to be consistently high, because that's what people are paying you for.
Yeah. If you are confident in your abilities, however, and you know that you are undergoing training, you know that you are on top of the pieces of work that you need to do,
mm-hmm.
and if you believe that your client's being picky or overcritical or just has unreasonable expectations, then you can start to feel pretty rubbish in yourself, and that's the time to start reminding yourself that actually the vast majority of your clients are happy with your work.
Mm-hmm.
Do they come back for more? And you're probably doing all right. Do they praise your work? If they do, you're probably doing all right. You know, do your blog posts or articles get lots of retweets? Again, you're probably doing all right. Not necessarily, but they're all indicators that you shouldn't feel bad about yourself. I should also say, however, that if you don't get lots of retweets or feedback, that doesn't automatically mean you're doing it all wrong. There are many forces at work. There are personalities. There's the weirdness of what Twitter likes and what it doesn't. And don't let criticism, whether it's valid or not, affect you in terms of your confidence and the sense you have of your abilities. As long as you can look at things objectively and say, yes, do you know, I think I am good at this, and really believe that, and you're not blagging clients and you're not giving in substandard work.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need to take a step back and say, okay, I'm getting criticism off this one person. It feels hurtful. It feels unfair. However, that's one person. I have other people who are supportive. I have other people who are happy with my work. And what they're saying isn't a reflection on me, it's more of a reflection on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And criticism, I think to finish off, I won't be bad cop this time. I'll be nice cop, good cop. Criticism is helpful.
It really can be.
It really, really can. It's not nice, the same way that putting a plaster on isn't nice, and pulling it off is certainly not nice. It feels hurtful, it feels horrible, but it has a benefit to it.
Yeah, we can all learn all the time, and we should be doing. It keeps life interesting, as well as keeping us good at our jobs.
This is it, you know, just because I'm sitting there saying, well, I'm doing an Open University course on fiction, and Philip's doing a UCL course on ethical journalism, doesn't mean that, you know, a little guy from one of my SME clients can't teach me a thing or two.
Oh, absolutely. If they're living and breathing that company and have done for 10 years, they know a lot of things you need to know.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter how many smarts you've got and how clever you are. If your client comes back to you and points out something, it might just be a silly little mistake. Take it on board, because you are going to improve. And the more you improve, the better your work will be. And the better your work is, the more you can charge. That's the moral of the story. No. Joking aside, the better your work is, the better everybody comes out, really.
Yeah.
The better the deal everybody gets. Everyone's happier, fewer mistakes, fewer instances of criticism, and life is just generally a little bit nicer.
I think so too. And now it is time for the Little Bird Recommendations of the Week, in which Laurie and I share something we've seen that we thought might be of interest to our listeners. So, Laurie, what is your Little Bird recommendation this week?
Well, this week I've been quite frivolous, I think. I've gone for something that's not particularly useful, and I'm going to say not at all useful, really, unless you get asked some obscure question in a pub quiz. But I found it really interesting, and I think it would be of interest to anyone who likes languages or language as a whole.
And I would hazard a guess that most of our listeners are in that category.
And if they're not, they shouldn't be our listeners. If you're a freelance writer and you don't like language, well,
reassess.
Freelance writer, yes. My recommendation is for a post from a lovely website called atlasobscura.com. And it's kind of like an encyclopedia / interactive map that sort of, it highlights some of the places off the beaten track and gives you information on some of the curious places in the world.
Lovely.
And in this particular post, the website is looking at something called the Silbo whistle language. And in Spanish it's known as El Silbo, because this is a language that helps the residents of one of the Canary Islands, La Gomera, communicate over long distances. Now, anybody who doesn't know sort of the geography of the Canary Islands is a Spanish-owned group of islands, but it's sort of based off the coast of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And they're volcanic. These have come up from the ocean oodles of years ago, because they're volcanic. So they're extremely rocky, and there are lots of mountains and valleys and crevices and ravines on these islands. So the people of La Gomera decided that they needed to be able to communicate with people sort of eons ago, before they had phones, because now you'd probably just text somebody. No problem in that. And they developed a language, so to speak, of whistles, and there are over 4,000 whistle words in this language.
Wow.
Amazing, but possibly slightly irritating. No, it's really, really lovely. One of the nice things about the Gomeran whistle language, El Silbo, is that it actually is a tonal language. And although I keep saying language, it's not specifically a language, it's a method of communication. It doesn't have all the hallmarks of a language.
Sure.
Which I won't get into now, things like grammar and what have you. But yeah, the fact that they have a tonal language that's entirely whistle-based, it's just something really lovely about that. And it was on the verge of extinction, I think, sort of at the start of, like, the tech era. So perhaps in the 1990s, 2000s, it had started to disappear a little bit, as we mentioned with text. But there's been a concerted effort to try and revive the language, and this is my favourite bit, by adding it to the public school curriculum.
Oh, that's fantastic. Can you imagine being a whistle teacher?
That would be amazing. And Today, 3,000 school children are in the process of learning El Silbo, and on the last day of September 2009, UNESCO gave protected cultural status to further protect it. Oh, I think that's lovely. It would be so annoying. Can you imagine, though, if you're just walking around La Gomera and you wanted to whistle a tune, you might actually accidentally really offend somebody by whistling something rude.
It is fascinating, and the fact that the language was born out of a very specific need based on geography is really interesting, that, you know, communication, shouting wasn't doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember when I was doing my A-level English, we were talking about the difference between pidgin language and Creole language. And I'm not sure if you, Pip, know the difference between those or knows.
No, I don't.
A pidgin language is a language that's cobbled together. So a particular example of that would be when people were stolen from their native lands to be slaves.
Right.
And they were brought to islands or communities where they were forced together and they had no method of communicating with one another. So they would take a word from here and a word from there, and they would cobble together a language in the hopes of being able to communicate with the people who were also in that situation with them. Now, when these people had children, what's interesting about children as they learn a language, and it's something called the language acquisition device, is that they will automatically impose a grammar on any language that they hear.
Yes.
And this is the difference between a pidgin and a Creole.
Right.
A pidgin, cobbled together language. And the Creole is the fact that the children have grown up using this cobbled together language, and something in their mind has automatically imposed a grammar on that set of communications.
That's amazing, because it is really interesting watching young children and language development, that there can be times when it looks like they're taking a step backwards.
Yeah.
But actually, it's because they are starting to apply grammatical rules. Like, they might have been saying, I went for a long time, but then suddenly start saying, I goed.
Yes.
And it sounds like they're getting worse because they used to get it right. But actually, what's happening is in their brain, they've figured out past participles.
Yeah.
And so rather than realize that that's an irregular verb, they're applying the rule, even if wrongly, but it's a sign that they're starting to understand those rules. It's really interesting.
No, I used to want to do sort of child language acquisition. I had to make a decision when I went to university whether to do linguistics and child language acquisition or whether to do translation, which is what I eventually did.
Yeah.
But it's hugely interesting, and it's interesting that language needs to be triggered.
Yeah.
I think it was King James of Scotland stole away a pair of twin boys in the hope of winning favour with the church back in the day.
As you do,
steal children. And he took them to an island off the coast of Scotland where he put them in accommodation with only deaf-mute servants.
Right.
So that nobody would be able to speak to them.
Mm.
His theory was that these children would grow up speaking, I can't remember if it's Hebrew or Aramaic.
Oh, right, like some kind of innate language.
Yes, he said it was God's language.
Right.
But yeah, no, he was convinced that these boys would grow up speaking a biblical language. And they didn't. They didn't speak at all because their language acquisition device hadn't been triggered.
And presumably if they were surrounded by deaf people, they would have picked up some degree of sign language.
Well, this is a theory. It's certainly not something that's been recorded, but yes, language acquisition device can be triggered in hearing children, in deaf children, by visual stimulus. So if you had a hearing child, but you didn't speak to that child vocally, you didn't communicate with that child verbally, but you communicated with that child using sign language, that would be the child's first language. They wouldn't start to speak if you trigger their LAD.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's hugely fascinating, and I just thought El Silbo was just really lovely, interesting, and curious, as you say, because it's born of a need that's created via geography as opposed to something else.
Yeah. When I was a child, I used to whistle all the time.
Yes.
And I used to get told off because apparently when you whistle, it makes Mary, Mother of God, blush.
Oh, dear.
which is quite a thing.
I've never heard that.
I know, and so I used to try not to whistle because I didn't want to make Mary, Mother of God, blush. But it was just, I didn't choose to whistle, I just always whistled.
I was the same. My dad taught me to whistle when I was 4.
Mm.
And I went to nursery, and within a week, the nursery teacher had called him in and said, please, can you stop your child whistling? But he couldn't, and I whistle constantly. I whistle all the time. This podcast is a challenge. Because I can't whistle. I whistle in the shower, I whistle when I'm walking, I whistle when I'm working. It's one of the big benefits from working from home.
Yes, I haven't whistled for years, but yeah.
Oh, you're missing out.
I bet.
So yes, that's my recommendation, rather strange one, but I think it's a charming one.
Oh, definitely. I'll definitely be reading that myself. Now, my recommendation is a blog post, and actually, I mentioned this earlier when Laurie mentioned people who call themselves writers but really can't be described as writers. And it's a blog post that has a provocative title, but if you bear with it, it contains some interesting information. Now, the blog post is called State of Freelance Writing and Why It'll Be Dead Within 1 Year.
Ooh, link bait.
Exactly. So, and I was as susceptible to that as everybody else, so I clicked it. Now, what it's actually about is good quality content and the proliferation of bad quality content. And it starts by talking about the Google Panda algorithm, which is what started de-ranking websites that were full of rubbish content. So that were full of just mass-produced, spun, badly written things suddenly lost their place in the search engine results. And there was a big phenomenon that you don't see so much anymore a couple of years ago called content mills, where writers were paid, well, where writers wrote lots and lots of content, and if people clicked on the ads on the pages, then they were paid a proportion of that. Lots of writers did it, very few made good money from it. And Panda pretty much killed the content mills. And then it goes on to talk about freelancing websites. Now, if you're not familiar with these things, freelancing websites are full of people who want writers who will write 500 words for $2. And depressingly full of writers who will write 500 words for $2.
Mm-hmm.
And the quality of the content is generally very, very low. Now, there's quite a nice, if snarky, quote in the middle of this, where the author says, unfortunately, there are excessive number of kids with laptops, a passing grade in English, and a warped sense of what a writer is. Read what they write, and you may arrive on the same conclusion. And
so true.
Yeah. And so the author is talking about people who take pride in calling themselves a writer, but who write very poorly.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to talk about the effect on lots of other freelance writers. He says, because the work is done and paid for online, the market can be influenced by anyone on the planet that is willing to do for 50 cents a job for which a real writer would deservedly charge $75. For instance, the Philippines has hundreds of thousands of writers writing for next to nothing to support themselves and their families. Now, he talks about the fact that the market's in a flux at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and that there are unscrupulous people, and there are also, you know, people who really take pride in good quality and everything in between. And so, with this context in mind, the author believes that the Panda update and Google's ongoing attempts to get spam out of their results, more and more of the poor quality content writers are going to find themselves penalised. And when they are penalised, the websites they've written for are penalised. And there will be a growing disincentive to pay pennies for poor quality content, and actually an increased incentive to pay decent amounts for what he has dubbed a content journalist,
mm-hmm.
who is somebody who will have a degree in journalism or some form of writing. They'll be well paid and smart enough to unite in a field protecting group.
It certainly sounds nice.
Yeah, and so his justification for the title, which is that the freelance writer is dead, freelance writing will be dead in a year, is that it will be replaced by content journalists, which appears to be a nice name for freelance writers who do charge a decent amount and provide really good quality.
I'd be interested to know how many people, if any, are dubbing themselves content journalists at this point.
It will be interesting to see also whether it takes on.
Yeah.
Takes off, rather. You know, will we start using that title? It will depend on whether it grows in popularity. I think at this stage, if I wrote that I was a content journalist, people wouldn't know what it meant.
I think I don't know if it's ironic. I'm always a bit wary about sort of using the word irony,
yes,
or ironic, because there's always someone that will go, you use this word, but it does not mean what I think you think it means.
And to be fair, we both do that with literally.
Of course we do. We literally do all the time. But no, I think ironically, or perhaps not ironically, depending on who you are and what you think,
mm-hmm,
content journalism as a term, it's a bit tautological.
Mm.
Do you not think?
Yes, there is that as well.
A content journalist. Well, a journalist is somebody who reports, who writes, and content is just content. I don't think it's a subdivision of journalism, really.
Yeah.
Even if you try and make it into a subdivision of journalism.
Yeah.
I think it can be tempting to want to ring fence yourself off from people that you feel are bringing down your profession and making life harder for you.
Yeah.
And it's true, people who will charge, you know, I've recruited before, and I have people contacting me saying, I'll do this work that you're offering £40 for, I'll do it for £3.50.
It's
no red lie. It's terrifying. And I do not hire these people, but I'm in the minority, I believe.
Yeah, a lot of people would.
Yeah, I mean, I've been on business forums and what have you, or indeed business fora, just to be correct. And you see people leaping at the opportunity to get free content in return for a link for somebody. Oh, I'll write you a 500-word blog post if you just link to my website. And they go, yeah, please, here's my email address. And it's pathetic.
I get daily emails from... I get daily emails from people to my professional website offering me free articles in return for a link.
It's so ridiculous.
Obviously, I've never done it, and I wouldn't, but not for that site anyway. But from their point of view, it's not worth it.
No, it isn't. It's not worth it at all. I think it shows a real lack of understanding of the algorithms that Google has put in place.
And a lack of... if they're good at what they do, then they're showing a lack of understanding at their own abilities.
Yeah, I mean, the person who offered the £3.50 piece of work had a degree in philosophy and a master's in history.
Yeah.
With prizes. They'd won prizes for their work.
Yeah, and if they're bad at what they do, they shouldn't be offering it in the first place.
Well, yes, quite. So I think I can understand where this guy's coming from, and the part of me that bridles at anybody and everybody calling themselves a writer when I work so hard to cement my position as a freelance writer and to offer my clients the quality of work they deserve.
Yeah.
That part of me wants to say, yes, I want to be a content journalist and I want content journalism to take off, but it wouldn't solve anything. You know, freelance writers are freelance writers. People who call themselves freelance writers, you know, you can't control what anybody calls themselves.
And if Scott Kuttner and you and I start calling ourselves content journalists, there is nothing stopping
exactly. The
£3.50 for 1,000 words person also calling themselves a content journalist, and then you're back in the exact same position you started in.
It's not a solution, is it, really? But what is? I wish that writers would be more ethical, and I wish that clients would be more discerning and really research what they can get for their money.
If nothing else, I'm sure you have this experience too. The number of clients that come to me having already spent 3 or 4 lots of $5 to try and get something written, and then by the fourth one have given in and said, okay, I'll pay someone properly and hire me to do what's been done 4 times already but horribly, and for me to either start again or fix it, which usually involves starting again. And they all say, I wish I hadn't bothered in the first place going to them, because although in the grand scheme of things it's not a lot of money, it's taken a lot of time, and it's still some money. I paid, you know, $14 more than I needed to, and wasted 3 weeks trying to get a decent piece of work.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you have the same. People come to you having tried that, and it doesn't work for most people.
No, it doesn't. And sometimes, if I'm in a good mood, I can sympathise and say, okay, this person is naive.
Yeah.
But it's naive at best.
Yeah.
Often, you'll find that people are simply trying to... I'm not going to go as far as exploit, but they are clinging to their money so tightly because they believe they should get something for nothing, or next to nothing. And that's what you get. You get exactly what you pay for, or you should get exactly what you pay for. If you pay more, you should get better quality writing. And if you pay less, if you pay ridiculously low amount, you should get ridiculous quality writing. It's quite simple. No person can produce writing at that speed for that money and still make a profit. Something has to give. I mean, there's that triangle, isn't there? I can do it well, I can do it quickly, and I can do it for just a little amount of money, and you can only choose two of those.
Yes. Yeah. And seeing some of what these people write, we're not even just talking about something that's a bit stilted, or something that's got a bit of bad grammar in. A lot of it is literal nonsense.
It's just nonsensical, isn't it? I've seen stuff that people have sent to you.
Yeah, and it just makes...
I've seen stuff that people have sent to me, haven't you?
Yeah, and it actually just doesn't even make sense. It's not that it can be quickly edited to make it British English and to sort out the commas. We're talking complete rewrite without... You know, like there isn't a sentence in the original that you can use.
It reads more like squashed up abstract poetry a lot of the time. You know, because somebody's gone through using a thesaurus. English perhaps isn't their first language, or they just don't care. And this is what you get. You get nonsensical content. And
something I still see website owners do that they really should know better by now is... hire someone good for what they call their money site.
Right.
Which is their main website. But then hire someone poor for external articles that will link back to the money site.
Oh, for goodness sake.
I know. And so they think this is a brilliant plan, that if they get Laurie or I to write their main content, that's what is client-facing. That's what people will read, and it's got to be good. But all their external marketing, for a start, they're still using article directory marketing, which is already more than unwise. It's actually damaging.
There's press release engines.
Exactly. Well. But also, they are honest about the fact that they don't care about the quality of the mass press release and the mass article release and the mass guest blogging attacks. That wasn't what I meant to say, but it was a very Freudian slip, because that is what it is. I get so many emails. So even some that are aware that good quality content matters are still only focusing that on their main site and could not care less what goes out in their name elsewhere. And that is what Google Penguin is targeting. Poor quality backlinks to your site, and so you're just asking for trouble if that's still your approach.
Well, you're shooting holes in your own boat, really, aren't you?
Yes.
You know, because if you're sending out, aside from Penguin, but if you're sending out poor quality content that's linking back to your site, you're doing it with express intention of improving your SEO.
Yeah.
Now, if those kind of articles shoot up the rankings, as you seem to think that they will, as the client, not you, Pip.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
They shoot up the rankings as they should, you know, in terms of decent SEO.
Mm.
If they're sitting there at the top of Google and they're the best results that people searching for your business will get, then it's also completely pointless.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first rule of SEO writing is to kind of forget about SEO and write for humans. Obviously, do keep it in mind, otherwise it's not SEO writing specifically, but humans are the most important consumer of what you write.
Yeah.
Search engines come second. And
oh, it's a good article, and I think it needs saying, even if I don't agree with his solution.
Yes, I think I'd be with you on that. I think his solution on first reading sounds good, and he's presented it in a way that will leave most freelance writers nodding their head vigorously.
It's wish fulfillment writing, I think.
Yeah, but like you say, I think the conclusion of simply a kind of rebrand as a content journalist in a brotherhood.
Our sisters will have to go somewhere else then.
Indeed. I think he's somewhat naive, and I think the idea that should the term content journalist take off as a sign of quality, then it will be adopted by anybody and everybody. And I think he's not looked at that necessarily. However, the article is good, and we were talking earlier about being appropriately angry, and I think this is that as well.
Yeah.
He expresses anger in an appropriate and controlled but clear way.
No, I think it's good. I think I wished he had summarised by saying we need to stick together a bit more, which he does say, but not his main summing up, really. His main summing up is that we need to have a different name for ourselves, you know, this rebrand.
Yeah.
And I think it's because freelance writing has been damaged. You know, the term freelance writing, freelance writer, it has been damaged because certain clients will say, well, what's the difference between you and this person? Why are they so much cheaper than you?
Yeah.
You
both write articles, don't you?
Yeah. So, but there's a danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, I think. If you throw out the term freelance writer, as you say and as I say, and take on content journalism or content journalist instead, the same thing will happen over and over again. The thing we need to do is to impress upon clients and to really distinguish for ourselves what we're offering in terms of quality and how that benefits people. So it's just another good reason, I think, for anybody wanting to make a living as a freelance writer to really know what you're talking about and to really research and do training and understand SEO so that you can say, as Pip and I have just said, look, these are the algorithms, this is what they do, this is what's going to happen to your business if you use this kind of poor quality content.
Yes, I think that's a very good point, because the onus is on business owners and webmasters who hire writers.
Mm-hmm.
We can do whatever we like and organise and come up with brilliance, but it's the people who do the hiring, isn't it, who really need the most profound shift in approach.
Well, this is it, because if we all band together, us or we content journalists, we band together, but we don't communicate with the outside world or with clients or prospective clients, they're just going to carry on. They're going to carry on with the people who offer the cheap deals and the poor quality content, because why not? They'll just lose to it.
Yeah.
Well, really interesting article. So that just about wraps up episode 46 of A Little Bird Told Me.
We are getting closer and closer to 50.
It's really frightening.
We're really proud, because it's going to be a real milestone, and we are very excited.
We are. I can almost not believe that we've got to 50.
But I know.
We were so determined, weren't we, that we wanted to start something that would be really beneficial, not just to us, because of all the research that we have to do, and let's face it, the amount of chat we get to have, but also for the people listening. And we really, really hope that you enjoy each and every episode of the podcast.
Definitely. So thank you for listening. Do head over to alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com for all the links we've been talking about, for a transcript of the episode, and to find out how to contact Laurie and I on our various websites and social media feeds. You will also find there links to subscribe to the podcast, because you know you don't want to miss an episode.
We'll be out every Tuesday morning, so to find all of those wonderful resources and links, go to alittlebirdtoldme.podomatic.com. I've been Laurie Hartshorn.
And I have been Philippa Willett, and we will see you next time.